It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Duquesne University is planning to establish a College of Osteopathic Medicine, which hopes to accept its first class of 75 students in the fall of 2023. We're going to talk about the perceived need for this training in the Pittsburgh area and how extensive an undertaking it is to create a new college within a university. David Dalsey is the provost of Duquesne University. David, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me.
So for those who might not know, what's the difference between an osteopathic medical program and what we would might say a standard medical program?
So the standard medical program is an allopathic school, and osteopathic has slightly different training. The focus on osteopathy is body, mind, and soul, and they spend a little bit more time looking at preventing disease before it happens rather than treating it after it occurs.
So is it a more holistic approach or what?
It is a more holistic approach, and the training is more holistic, although the accreditation standards are the same and the boards are the same. So the quality of the training is the same, but the focus of it is slightly different.
Accreditation, you mean that a osteopathic physician can do, has the license, the certification to do the same things as a MD, as we would call it.
Exactly. The same thing, except their abbreviation is DO, but they function right alongside the MDs. And as a matter of fact, many people have probably interacted or been served by a DO and might not have even realized it.
Okay. So is the holistic approach not included in, quote again, those traditional medical schools? And is it more of a philosophy and approach rather than different courses of study?
It is a bit of a philosophy and an approach, although there is, you know, a different focus in the training. There are manipulations and adjustments that DOs do that MDs don't. And so when you look at the training, there are differences. But when it comes to the core principles of medicine and what you do as a medical doctor, they are the same.
I hear manipulations, I start thinking of a chiropractor. Is there similarities there or what?
There would be similarities in terms of, you know, adjustments and other things that you would do to help someone who was experiencing physical discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Several years ago, Duquesne University considered starting the traditional, was it allopathic?
It was an allopathic school, yes.
Medical school, but opted against it. So what has changed and why is now the right time?
A few things have changed. First, when we were looking into the allopathic medical school, when you go into that world, you also go into a world of heavy-duty research. And at this point, it requires hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in research infrastructure. So that's one of the reasons why Duquesne thought against doing it last time. We're focused on the DO this time in part because of the shortage of primary care doctors in this region and also the shortage of family care practitioners. We want to make sure that we train individuals who are interested in pursuing those things and potentially helping out with rural healths, federally qualified health centers, and others.
So there is a shortage of what we would call PCPs, personal care physicians?
Absolutely.
And so those two factors combined, the investment that the university would have to make.
Yes.
And then you got to have a demand.
Yes.
That's why there's this, pardon the pun, this confluence of the idea.
Exactly. And we did almost an entire year worth of due diligence before deciding to do this behind the scenes with a consultant that we worked with to make sure there was a demand and to make sure that the region actually needed this.
Mm-hmm. So the DOs, or they're specialized in family care, individual care. Is that it then?
Well, they do. So, you know, if you're a DO, you can go into any specialty like any other medical doctor. It's just that DOs are more likely to go into family practice and primary care than MDs.
Is this program meant to compete with University of Pittsburgh's medical school, which is the allopathic style?
It is not, and we are very proud to partner with the University of Pittsburgh and their medical school. It is one of the nation's premier medical schools. We've had extensive conversations with leadership at the University of Pittsburgh, with the leadership of UPMC, and we are looking for the synergies and the ways that we can work together rather than ways where we can be duplicative. We already have a top-tier allopathic medical school. Our desire is not to try to replicate that.
So can you give us an idea what that sort of partnership might look like or how one might help the other?
Sure. I mean, there is the desire for potential clinical placements. UPMC is very interesting in that that organization has grown exponentially, as we all know, whereas the medical school at Pitt has not. And so there are more hospitals and potentially more training sites at UPMC than the University of Pittsburgh could completely use, because the University of Pittsburgh has been very good to keep their medical school class small and quite elite at this point, being one of the top medical schools in the country. So there is a greater capacity in the UPMC system. But I should also emphasize, we are not exclusively partnering with UPMC. We'll be having conversations with folks at Allegheny Health Network and the Hospital or Healthcare Council of Western Pennsylvania and others to see ways in which we can partner.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking to Duquesne University Provost David Dowsey about Duquesne's plan to start a College of Osteopathic Medicine with the first class to enter in 2023. David, how do you imagine Duquesne University as a Catholic university might influence the medical curriculum?
Well, we're really excited because DO schools are traditionally standalone schools, and they're not usually linked with a broader university. So being a Catholic institution allows us to bring together some of the discussions of ethics and medical ethics, and also some of the unique approaches that we might take to that topic. As well as we have this tremendous capacity at Duquesne to study health science. We have a health science school, we have a pharmacy school, we have a nursing school, we have a natural and environmental science school. We hope to leverage all of those to create a really tremendous osteopathic medical school.
According to the American Association of Colleges of Osteopathic Medicine, every year more than 6,500 osteopathic physicians enter the workforce. Number one, do you expect that demand to continue? And that number, are we getting more osteopathic physicians than, quote, MDs these days?
We are, actually. The osteopathics is the fastest growing segment of new medical doctors. There's a bunch of reasons why, but it also, I think, has to do with the fact that osteopathic medicine has become more normalized. When it first started, there were more stark differences between the MD and the DO. As it's evolved and as things have progressed, the two degrees have really become more similar. With differences of philosophy and approach, but still the same boards and the same accreditation.
Will the curriculum be just as demanding as we hear that, a Pitt Medical School, another medical school's curriculum is?
Unfortunately for the medical students, it absolutely will be.
So what is your plan? What is Duquesne's plan to attract students to a new college?
We have a multi-pronged approach. The first is we want to leverage our existing health programs, and we believe that because we have so many different health programs, dozens of them, that there is an interprofessional training opportunity that we feel will be very attractive to students. We are spending a lot of time really thinking about how we leverage those opportunities to attract the best medical students.
Mm-hmm. What fields of medicine will your program prepare the students? You talked about, the primary care, the personal care, but will the curriculum also allow for exploration into specialties?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, just like an MD program, our students will touch on every part of medicine, from gynecology through radiology, et cetera. They will have experiences with every single area of medicine, and then they will ultimately, just like the MDs, decide where they want to go.
All right, so you made the decision, you're moving forward. I mean, just how big of an investment is this for Duquesne University in dollars and cents?
It will be the largest investment in the university's history. It is a costly endeavor to create any medical school. There are a lot of things that are put in place, for example, by the accreditation body, which ups the cost. For example, you need to set aside $40 million to teach out the program just in case you don't get accredited, with a total investment north of $100
million. Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left. Do you anticipate using existing facilities? So will there be more construction on Duquesne's campus, and where, if that would be the case?
There will be more construction on Duquesne's campus. We will leverage existing facilities, but we plan to build an 80,000 to 100,000 new medical school building. It will be on Forbes Avenue, and it will be close to the power center that is currently at Duquesne.
Would that be the old Robert Morris building? Or
no, it will be sort of, there's a parking lot right across from the parking garage at Duquesne, and that will be where the new medical school building will reside.
All right, so next step, is it finding a dean? Is that the next step in this progress?
Absolutely. We'll be announcing our dean search next week. We have Storbick Pimentel, a national search firm, to help out.
What are you looking for in a dean?
Experience, knowledge, compassion, and most importantly, somebody that will fit in with our mission and our desire to train students to be game changers in the healthcare field.
And when do you want to have that person in place? And would it be so that you can then that person would either lead the development or help in the development of the curriculum itself?
Absolutely. We hope in the new year, shortly after the new year, we will have that person in place and they will be developing the curriculum and working with all of our staff to get the new medical school off the ground.
In our last minute, what other steps must you do to get accredited?
It's a long process. We will begin a feasibility study, which will start when we hire the new dean. That takes more than a year. You have to develop the curriculum, and there are a wide variety of other things that the accreditor puts in place to ensure that you're offering the best quality education possible.
You have to recruit a dean. Then the dean has to help recruit the faculty.
Right.
This is a big project for Duquesne.
It's a really big project. We're excited. We've decided that being bold and taking decisive action is exactly what we want to do.
David Dalsey is the provost of Duquesne University, which plans to open a College of Osteopathic Medicine in the fall of 2023. Dr. Dalsey, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Between ER and the Marvel Universe, actress Ming-Na Wen is no stranger to big franchise success, and her most famous role remains creating the voice of Fa Mulan in the 1998 Disney animated classic. But before all of that, she even had a role on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And after a year and a half of studying the Pittsburgh International Airport, artist-in-residence Blaine Siegel has unveiled his work that captures the goings-on behind the scenes at the airport. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Three people had to be rescued this week after their boat became wedged under a barge. It happened overnight near the West End Bridge, and according to media reports, the barge operator wasn't even aware that he had hit a boat. Authorities say the passengers were lucky to have only suffered minor injuries. And police are looking for a bandit who stole nearly 30 signs from a Pennsylvania roadway. They were primarily taken from the Somerset Pike Corridor in Somerset County. The person or people responsible face at least $1,300 in fines. Find more top stories on our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One woman is dead, another wounded, after an attack in downtown Pittsburgh late yesterday morning. The suspected assailant has been arrested. WESA reporter Lucy Perkins has been covering this story and joins us in studio with an update. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning.
Lucy, let's start with some of the basics. What happened? What do we know about the woman who was killed?
Sure. So yesterday at about 11:40 a.m., according to Pittsburgh police, an officer was on regular patrol on 6th Avenue, downtown Pittsburgh, and he saw a woman in distress. She's been described as maybe having fallen asleep or passed out at a bus stop. So he went to do a routine welfare check on her. And when he was speaking with her, a man allegedly came up behind her with a knife and attacked her and then attacked another woman on the street.
All right. So the officer, plain clothes or
nope,
in uniform?
He was in uniform.
In uniform.
Yeah.
Okay. And the woman was at like a bus shelter bench kind
Correct.
Of setting?
Yeah.
Okay. So the police officer was there talking or checking on the victim. The second woman was attacked. Was she there at the, you know, right there with that woman, or was she just walking by, or what?
Yeah, it seems to be, according to the police, a random attack. She was just walking by the bus stop, but they were both attacked and hurt by this man who had this knife. The police officer put the alleged assailant in custody and then attended to both of the women's wounds. They were sent to the hospital, and one woman died.
Right. And the second woman who was attacked, do we know her condition at this point?
The last update was that she was in stable condition. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the man who's accused of this fatal attack?
Right. So allegedly, the man who did this, the police arrested James Wyatt. He's 23, a McKeesport resident. They arrested him yesterday evening and charged him with criminal homicide and aggravated assault.
Are they saying anything at this point? I know it's early, mm-hmm. but are they saying anything about motive?
No. When they gave us an update last night, the motive was still under investigation. They're looking into it. But as far as they can tell, this was not racially or religiously motivated attack, and it appears to be random.
And any idea whether he knew the woman who he allegedly killed?
It's unclear.
Unclear at this mm-hmm. Okay. So, as you alluded to, there was initial concern that this might be a hate crime. Mm-hmm. Why did that concern rise early on?
There was reporting from a local news outlet, not WESA, of course, that witnesses had said that two women wearing hijabs were allegedly attacked in downtown Pittsburgh. The police quickly called that out as irresponsible and said that, you know, local media outlets should wait for the facts, because that ended up not being the case. The woman who died was not wearing any sort of religious garb, according to police. And the second woman, it's under investigation whether or not she was wearing a hijab.
Yeah, I think the police statement late last night said
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
All right. So there was a shooting downtown on July 4th. And now this stabbing a month later, some officials have suggested these incidents are indicative of a larger crime problem. Police have said, no, that's not the case. Is there any sense yet of how City Hall feels about it in the wake of yesterday's attack?
You know, there hasn't been any official statement from the mayor or City Hall yet, so we're just going to have to wait and see.
WESA reporter Lucy Perkins, thanks so much. We'll look forward to your continued coverage on this sad incident.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Actress Ming-Na Wen will be honored alongside celebrities like Robert Downey Jr. and Bette Midler later this month as the newest class of Disney legends at a Disney exposition. Ming-Na Wen is most recognized for her role as the voice of Mulan in the 1998 Disney animated feature film, and more recently as Agent Melinda May in Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But she's also a Pittsburgher and a Carnegie Mellon University graduate. She spoke recently with The Confluence's Kylie Kaczynski.
Ming, what does it feel like to be honored in this way? Walk us through how you found out.
Actually, it's a funny story. I was doing some ADR work at Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and I came out and my phone rings, and it was my manager. And he's like, you got an email from a letter from Bob Iger. I was like, oh, about what?
And this is from Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney.
Yeah, okay. The Bob Iger. And congratulations. We want to, you have been selected as a Disney legend. And I proceeded to well up with tears. It was quite a surprise. My EP came out and was like, are you okay? You know, why you look so upset? And I was like, no, these are tears of joy. I'm now a Disney legend.
What does that word mean to you, Disney legend?
I don't know. I mean, I get razzed about it a lot on set right now, so it's kind of funny.
Walk around with a bit of air of confidence. You're a legend now.
Yeah, you know, whenever I come on set now, the first AD always announces, oh, everybody, okay, quiet, legend is approaching. So I think it's wonderful. You know, I know I've worked really hard and have been in this business for over 3 or 4 decades now. And it's just an honor, and I'm humbled by it. I cannot believe I'm in the same list with people like Bette Midler and, you know, and Darth Vader, for crying out loud, the voice of Darth Vader, James Earl Jones.
Well, speaking of iconic voices, you voiced the title character of Mulan in the 1998 Disney animated classic. It's hard to believe it's been more than 20 years since this film came out, and it still resonates with families all these years later. What is it about this story that endures?
It's just a coming-of-age story about self-discovery and following your heart, you know, about a young girl who felt like she was trapped in an environment and a world where she couldn't be her true self. And then because she was doing something purely out of love, you know, love for her father, not wanting him to get hurt in battle because he was already, you know, elderly and injured. And then to come away with this incredible adventure of befriending people that she probably never would have befriended. And then, you know, end up saving China. So I think all of it is just about finding the hero or the heroine within yourself by believing in yourself, by just following your heart. And I think that resonates, you know, forever. It's just a beautiful story.
Disney's been rebooting its animations into live-action films for years, and Mulan is finally getting her turn in 2020 after a reported number of early-stage rounds of production. What does it feel like to see a new cast of actors take on this story?
I think any time that you're keeping a beautiful story, especially one that's so centrally focused on Asians, or you know, especially for me because I'm Chinese and I'm very proud that I'm, you know, I'm Chinese, to have that particular story being kept alive and retold. And Disney does an amazing job. They've done amazing work on Beauty and the Beast and Maleficent, and you know, and I know Lion King is out there right now as a different form of live action, but they do such a remarkable job in doing that translation of an animation that I think it looks beautiful. The trailer looks amazing, so I'm very, very excited that you know, a new generation of kids and adults is going to discover this particular story of Fa Mulan.
There was some initial concern about whitewashing the male lead in this remake, but Disney has since promised to commit to an all-Asian cast. Does this commitment surprise you at all?
No. I know even 20 years ago, you know, when Barry Cook and Tony Bancroft and Pam Coates, our directors and producers, were casting the part, they were very cognizant of wanting to stay with as many, you know, if not Chinese voices, but Asian voices for the majority of the roles. So I think it would have been a bit foolhardy of them to have not cast this with an all-Asian cast.
Fans of the original shouldn't expect to see Mulan's dragon sidekick Mushu, and it really doesn't seem like these characters would break out into song based on the trailer. What do you make of these changes? It almost seems like a more serious tone for this adventure.
Yeah, I really think it is, because, you know, the original story of Fa Mulan is a bit dark and very serious, and, you know, it's about going into war, which is never a cheerful subject.
Sure.
I think for Disney to want to take it into this visual image in telling the story, it's more true to form to the original folklore. And I think it's exciting, you know, there's a maturity about Disney at this point too, to want to tell stories that can still resonate and can still talk about a young girl discovering her own strength, and yet not make it be so childish in its way, but still keep the child at heart within the story, you know, because we have that with the animated Mulan. So why not do something different and something exciting and visually epic?
Can we expect a cameo by you or any other homage to the original Mulan?
As I always say when I am doing interviews with any Marvel, I will say this with you. I can neither confirm nor deny.
Marvel training has really got you.
I will be there in spirit if yes, I'm not course. In it. Yes, there we go. Yeah.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kylie Kaczynski, and I'm speaking with Ming-Na Wen, actress, Pittsburgher, and member of the 2019 class of Disney Legends. You're no stranger to playing strong women on screen. Disney is also recognizing you for your work as Agent Melinda May on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Is there something about these powerful roles that calls to you?
Yeah, they certainly cast me in them a lot, you know. And I'm pretty much like the antithesis of Agent May. So
really?
It's kind of, I don't know what they're seeing, but hey, if I can fill those shoes, I'm more than happy to. Yeah, I am the giggliest, girly, you know, silly, naughty. if there's an innuendo somewhere, I will find it. Even when there isn't one, I'll find it in the script. So yeah, and you know, and I mean, I can be strong in my definitely and determined and ambitious, but it's funny. It's funny that I get cast in these very strong role models. I mean, I consider myself, I guess, in my own silly way, you know, quite capable. Let's put it that way.
Are you drawing any additional inspiration from real life people when you play these strong female characters?
Oh yes, my mother, number one for sure. I mean, this woman, you know, survived communism, was able to raise two kids as a single mom on a shoestring, and then be able to, you know, bring them to America, remarry, and pretty much have her kids really embody the American dream, you know, like becoming a Disney legend. It's pretty awesome. Yeah, my mom is definitely my inspiration.
Well, speaking of your mother, you moved to Pittsburgh when you were 11, Mount Lebanon to be specific. What was it like coming here as a kid?
Not too happy, I will be quite frank.
You came from New York City, is that right?
Well, first Hong Kong.
Right, right.
Which was a major metropolis, right? Big, tall buildings everywhere. You know, hustle and bustle. And then New York. And then to come to suburbia, USA, it was definitely a culture shock. And I definitely was very, very resistant and unhappy. And, you know, Mount Lebanon was a predominantly white neighborhood. You know, I used to remember, like, I would say, like, I would get upset when I'd be made fun of or whatever. And I would say to the girl, like, I'll meet you after school. You know, like the New Yorker in me would just, like, come out. And they'd be like, what?
Meet you in the parking lot.
And these suburban girls would be like, what are you talking about? So, but, you know, I definitely adapted and found my circle of friends and, you know, nerd things like Dungeons and Dragons and video games, arcades, that all definitely helped the transition quite a bit. And now, I mean, you know, there's no better place to grow up than in Pittsburgh. It has a lot of wonderful people and like kind of like a small town mentality with, you know, with a great city behind it. So, and my parents' restaurant.
Yeah,
you know,
your family
Chinatown
owns
Inn.
Right, the Chinatown Inn on 3rd Avenue downtown, where I imagine you picked up a number of shifts. Do you have many memories there?
Yeah, I learned so much, you know. I mean, I was working there as a little girl, and I learned about business. I learned about delegating responsibilities and what, you know, developed an incredible work ethic. And I remember after I graduated from Carnegie Mellon, I mean, one of the things that they never really taught us was the business side of show business. And thank goodness for the restaurant, because when I went to New York, like, I would think of my agents or, you know, casting people or the directors or whoever I had to work with as, like, you know, the cook or the waiter or you know, the delivery man, and I was the restaurant. Like, I was the person that was necessary in creating the business aspect of it. And that's how I kind of viewed my acting career.
Another Pittsburgh tie you carry is an appearance or two on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. What was that like? How old were you?
How iconic is that?
It's incredible.
I love it. I know. I was so happy when the Mr. Rogers Twitter account reposted the clips, because, you know, I didn't have the clips from those episodes, and they had reposted it when I became a Disney legend. They reposted it and said, it all started here in Pittsburgh. I just remember it was so exciting. We were in college, me and my buddies, and they asked us to be trumpeteers for King Friday. And we got to meet Mr. Rogers. He is exactly as you see him on TV. Exactly. And it was just, you know, I wish we had cell phones back then, because I didn't get a picture with Mr. Rogers. You know, we didn't bring our cameras and stuff. We
right,
just,
of course.
So I'm hoping that Mr. Rogers might have a picture of us with him. I don't know. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that they had taken some pictures on set. I'm not sure. But yeah, how wonderful. That's definitely one of the highlights in my career.
So your resume is pretty impressive. You've had stints on ER, soap opera roles, obviously Mulan and Agent May. Have you had a favorite role?
This is a Sophie's Choice question, isn't it?
Yes. I'm asking you to make the choice.
Let me think. For me, I seriously think it's going to have to be Mulan. You know, it's a role that has had incredible impact in the kids that watched it 20 years ago, and their parents now themselves, and they bring their kids who also love Mulan, and that's definitely my favorite role. Although I do like Agent May, because it's really paid the bills quite a lot the last 7 years.
Ming-Na Wen is an actress, Carnegie Mellon University graduate, Pittsburgher, and Disney legend. Ming, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yes, I really appreciate this, and I always consider myself a Pittsburgher, so it's good to be talking to you.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh International Airport this week debuted the work of its first artist-in-residence. The project was 18 months in the making, and 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll followed it the whole way. Here's his report.
Blaine Siegel was given 1 year to make an artwork that reflected the place and its people. As he told some warehouse workers on a tour in March 2018...
I'm trying to learn about everything at the airport.
That's a big undertaking. The airport is an all-day, everyday operation spread over nearly 9,000 acres. It's home base for some 5,000 workers and welcomes nearly 10 million travelers a year. Staffers helped the locally based Siegel explore the bowels of the airport, miles of hallways and workshops. At the warehouse, he told workers about the project.
So I'll be interacting with the public, people, the passengers coming through, the employees, creating interactions.
Siegel visited everything from the air traffic control tower to the on-site fire department. Once, he joined baggage handlers out on the tarmac.
It's a remarkable experience. One, the sense of scale you have compared to a plane. You feel so miniature and so small. And then this whole area of the tarmac, no one is allowed out there. And it felt very much like looking out over the ocean, looking out over a place you cannot attain.
Siegel got his own studio, an unused room at the airport. He even had his own uniform made.
I wanted to have something that set me apart from everyone else here, but also made me a part of the airport, and I thought a jumpsuit would be fantastic.
The airport already has plenty of art, including that famous mobile in the airside terminal by Alexander Calder. But Siegel had a specific focus.
It was very important to me to use materials that could only be found at the airport and that could only be made at the airport.
He was drawn to the airport's paint test pad.
You see satellite images, it's this giant oblong circle, and it's just color upon color overlapping. Some of the most beautiful things you'll ever see.
The pad's a remote 2-acre patch of asphalt where workers test the gear for painting lines on the runways.
It's yellow, black, white. They do red. Red is less frequent, but it's all infused with reflective glass beads. So that when light hits it, it gets really brilliant.
Siegel saw the patterns as a kind of found abstract art.
It's constantly evolving and constantly changing. So I wanted to capture that energy as directly as I could, short of, you know, getting in and scraping it all up and gluing it onto something.
Siegel carpeted a section of asphalt with roofing shingles and reclaimed vinyl wallpaper.
The guys I'm working with the trucks, they think I'm kind of crazy because I find the painting so beautiful.
That's the sound of a sprayer.
When he first came over, we kind of didn't understand what he was doing. And then he started to lay down his canvases, and we ran him over, and we were like, oh, all right, it's kind of making sense now.
Philip Jandrakovic is a line striper.
To see your work on the airfield and then on a canvas as art, it was like two different, totally different things. So.
Siegel did some cutting and reassembly of the materials. The result made the paint crew guys like driver Brian West feel a little differently about their jobs.
We just thought it was just, you know, for the FAA and the airport, but now I guess, you know, more people can enjoy it. So, and now it's an art project. It wasn't just for pilots.
The three 23-foot-long paintings, series of bold, overlapping lines in multiple colors, were hung last week on three big concrete joists in the main food court. Travelers walk right under them. Rachel Rierich is airport arts and culture manager.
Blaine's had the opportunity to really go behind the scenes and kind of make the invisible scene.
Travelers like Jessica Fry of the South Hills seem pleased.
It's abstract, but it's like trying to look like a cityscape, or at least that's my interpretation of it.
Others noted Siegel's color scheme. Stephanie Griffin is a TSA employee from Aliquippa flying to Dallas.
Seemed like with these, he's a Steeler fan because it's this yellow and black, gold and black going on.
The Steelers' like color scheme is a coincidence. Black and yellow are just two main colors the paint crew uses. But Siegel doesn't mind the association. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And WESA's Bill O'Driscoll is with us in studio now. Bill, Pittsburgh International, they already had plenty of art, but that was artwork that sort of brought in from the outside. What did the airport officials want from an artist in residence?
Kevin, they wanted to connect the sort of people who work at the airport, the people who travel there, and the airport itself in a way that was particular to Pittsburgh. So that's what Blaine Siegel, the artist in residence, was trying to do, to make something that was like a site-specific kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Blaine Siegel visited everything from the air traffic control tower to the carpentry shop. Did he want to sort of pull back the curtain on places we don't see, don't have access to? And were there some other places that you wanted to include that you didn't have time for in your story?
Yeah, sure. Definitely this paint pad that he ended up using, that's a big one. Most people never see that at all or even think about it, but it's there and it's really interesting to look at. Other places he found, so apparently there's an extended a part of the tram car tunnel that never got used, and it's sort of like crystals have begun to form in there, like in a cavern. He got to visit that, kind of crazy. They have a place where they test jet engines. And he got to see that. It's again, behind the scenes kind of things, along with more prosaic things like the storehouse and the carpentry shop.
Makes me want to follow him around. So he's immersed himself in his subject matter. What did he tell you his experience learning about all the insider stuff at the airport?
Just like how vast of an operation it is, and you have all these people running around in these tunnels, miles of tunnels that go through the airport that are just behind the scenes. You never see them. He started to think of the airport as kind of like a living organism, really, that had to constantly replenish its sources of nourishment. And these, you know, these the people were like almost the cells that keep it alive.
Mm-hmm. So many of us just rush through the airport trying to check in, get through security, get to the proper gate for our flight. So after following the artist as you did and seeing the finished work, do you think passengers will now stop and look at his work?
I think they will. Yeah, I've seen people stop and look at other art there. And if they have time, right, if they're not like right up against it, I'm sure they will.
Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Thanks so much, Bill.
Sure thing, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, How dangerous is disinformation when it's spread on social media? Does it threaten more than political campaigns? We'll speak with the director of CMU's new Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.